welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. We're continuing to build your understanding so that we can empower you even more. Because remember, knowledge is power, and it doesn't become power until you act upon it. So that's why we encourage you to learn, pray, and act. So I'm getting better at consolidating this. But anyway, so it is all about compliance to the Constitution, not cherry picking. Oh, well, we want you to at least do this. We have to demand of our public servants that they fully comply. When we ask them or we give them leave to be able to do something else, where do we stand in demanding that they comply with what we want them to comply with? You can't do that. You have to hold them fully accountable. And it's only when we do that, folks, that they will have the fear of God in them. Because now they know we are serious. We don't care, you know, how much gold they're going to throw at us, because it'll kill us. Either way, taking our gold or throwing gold at us, it's going to kill us. Giving them powers that they don't have the authority to do is the biggest mistake we can give or allow, whatever. Right? I mean, come on, Tammy.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we...
Yeah, I just don't understand, you know, when and... When I submit this petition, they'll just go, oh, who cares? And then what?
So we have to start saying this, you know, when women were oppressed, people had to stand up. And it wasn't just women themselves that had to stand up. Women could not successfully, I don't think, women could have done it completely on their own. It's just like blacks could not have come out from, you know, under the oppression on their own. Right?
Yeah.
So we have to be a part of the change, all of us. We have to, you know, stand up and say, you know, no more. It was a great run. Congratulations. You got as far as you did. But now that you've really pissed us off, no more. It's done.
Mm-hmm. Now, so, again, like when... When we give the petition and they hand it over to the county attorney and the county attorney just says, meh, then what?
Well, so, as a matter of fact, then you need to chastise your representatives for handing it over to the attorney. This is a petition for them for redress. The attorney is not our government. The judges and the court is not our government. The executives and the bureaucracies is not our government. Maybe they need a lesson on what a Republican form of government is. A Republican form of government is representation of the sovereigns and the rule of law. And so if they did, then we need to call them out to say, that is how you're getting away with not doing your job. I petitioned you. That's why if you read in these petitions, we actually have a clause at the very end that this petition is for you and you alone. This is not for an attorney or for the court. We have a Republican form of government, and we demand our representatives redress our grievances. And so, they don't think that they actually are responsible, because nobody understands this Republican form of government anymore, because the judiciary has successfully taken over. Mm-hmm. Or at least they've convinced us they're in charge. That's the thing. They haven't successfully taken over, because that would have been an amendment to do that. So I was wrong. Boom, really quick. Wow, that was out there. I was wrong. What they have done is they've convinced us that they are in charge when they're not.
Yeah.
And that's when you can poke that lawyer in the face and go, you know what? I'm going to slap a petition on you for misrepresenting the good people of this county by saying that they don't have to do anything because they are our representatives. We need to get back to the day when professional lawyers are looked down upon. Folks, If you haven't read the New Testament, I would encourage you to do so. Because even Christ had disdain for lawyers. Because he understood what they were doing at that point in time. And that's how long they've been around being the devil's advocate. Right? That's what they do. They, let me play the devil's advocate here. Yeah. Let's see how well that works for you. So anyway, we are in the Virginia ratification phase. We are still, I think, still in June 14th, or is it 15th yet? Let me see here. We're still June 14th. I have not seen the 15th come yet. Oh, no. We just passed. So it's not the 15th. The 15th was Sunday. 14th was Saturday. So we just
actually June 16th.
16th, yes. I just saw that. And so Henry made a comment regarding common law. And so Madison responded, and you just read this, but we didn't have I didn't have time to really chime in. So I want everybody to hear this in context. And let me go up to the common law, to this one line. It's very short of what Mr. Henry says. The honorable gentleman said that the militia should be called forth to quell riots. We have not seen this business go on very well today without military force. It is a long-established principle of the common law of England that civil force is sufficient to quell riots. Okay, so civil force. What is civil force? What is he talking about there? Civil force should be the militia.
I mean, the militia, yeah.
Right, okay. So Madison then basically responds, and that's what we're going to reread again. So thank you so much.
An act passed a few years ago in this state to enable the government to call forth the militia to enforce the laws when a powerful combination should take place to oppose them. This is the same power which the Constitution is to have. There is a great deal of difference between calling forth the militia when a combination is formed to prevent the execution of the laws and the sheriff or constable carrying with him a body of militia to execute them in the first instance, which is a construction not warranted by the clause. There is an act also in this state empowering the officers of the customs to summon any persons to assist them when they meet with obstruction in executing their duty. This shows the necessity of giving the government power to call forth the militia when the laws are resisted. It is a power vested in every legislature in the Union, and which is necessary to every government. He then moved that the clerk should read those acts, which were accordingly read.
Okay. So, to be clear, every citizen, you put your citizenship in jeopardy if you fail, when called upon, to serve the needs of the law. Now, in a monarchy, as a citizen of the kingdom of what have you, but it doesn't matter, the king can call upon his subjects, his citizens, to serve him. And, you know, for whatever purpose. For washing his feet, for, you know, giving him their bedroom so that he can rest on his travels. The king can literally put you out because the kingdom is his. Everything is his. Property rights are not the same in a monarchy. And so when we look at what we have here, property rights were fully vested in the people. And what wasn't vested in personal property, the states are the stewardships of. They have the stewardship of these, of the land. So, breaking down this one section, he pointed out that when there's a powerful combination, that's what he's up at the very top, when a powerful combination should take place to oppose the law, to oppose government, this is the same power which the Constitution is to have. So that we can easily go in and shut it down. It is not acceptable behavior. He goes on and says, and the sheriff or constable carrying with him a body militia to execute them in the first instance, which is a construction not warranted by the clause. In other words, the fact that the sheriff has the ability to go do this on his own is not warranted by the clause of the Constitution. In other words, the Constitution doesn't call for the sheriffs to do anything. The only time that the Constitution is going to invoke the militia is when the state basically says, we can't suppress this. We can't repel this invasion. We can't enforce these laws. Then, at that point, because the federal government says, hey, collect the taxes, collect the taxes, collect the taxes. And in Pennsylvania, they were trying. And it came down to the point where Pennsylvania wasn't paying taxes for a few years there. Western Pennsylvania wasn't. And so Washington they were really trying his patience to a point where he said, that's it, I got to deploy the militia. We got to execute these laws. He should have done it right out the get-go. And as a matter of fact, anybody that, you know, raises children or what have you, if you're not clear and concise and deliberate in your instructions and so forth, and then chastise immediately, then you have problems. Does that not make sense?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you tell a child, you shouldn't do that, and they do it, and they get electrocuted because they're putting their finger in the thing, into a little socket, then whose fault is that? That's the parent's fault. And as a matter of fact, you know, that's one of the reasons why we have to, you know, immediately engage, especially when the circumstances warrant it. But more importantly, he goes on and says, this is an act also in this very state empowering the officers of the customs, in other words, the sheriffs and law keepers, to summon any person to assist them when they meet with obstruction in executing their duty. In other words, if you don't assist, then believe you me, you will be duly noted as a resisting person and not assisting, and you will suffer the consequences like those who are breaking the law. We're obligated to ensure that the law is being kept. So, who's at fault because our politicians are breaking the law?
It's our fault.
There you go. It is our obligation. We have a self-government, and because the courts have convinced us that you have a right to go out and protest, that is your right of, you know, redress. That's your right of, you know, petitioning. No, it's not. It's very clear that you have a right to assemble and petition government, not go out in the corners and put the fear of, you know, in everybody's eyes and minds that you might burn down the town like has happened in the past. No, that is uncivil behavior. That is uncivil rest or unrest. That is what I call civil unrest, where the people, you know, start rising up, burning things and so forth. So this shows the necessity of giving the government power to call forth a militia when the laws are resisted. It is a power vested in every legislature in the Union, and then Madison proves it, that every legislature is to have that power. Now, with the Dick Act, because the Constitution has not been amended, they use this Dick Act to basically instruct the states not to be doing these things. That right there was a huge, I'll just say, bait and switch. Oh, well, we're going to do this, but you're not going to be able to protect yourselves anymore. And that's exactly where we are today, folks. We don't have sheriffs with the militia in every county. That's why when you see throughout the states where there's this uprising and, you know, things being damaged, people getting hurt, property being destroyed, then that's because the sheriff doesn't understand his job in protecting property and lives and doesn't deploy the militia, because we've been told that by the courts that they have this right to be out there. That's not true. There's no state in the Union that has a law that allows you to violate the rights of others. Let's be clear. Any protest in the streets, on the sidewalks, If you're out in the area of commerce, where commerce flows, you are denying people their right of the flow of commerce, for them to get to work, for them to be able to buy, sell, or move their commerce for somebody to buy and sell. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
There's nowhere in the union where you can start walking out onto the freeway and get away with it. Those people who were doing that are denying the civil rights of everybody else. And why is it that we're tolerating it? Because the judges, the unconstitutional litigation, or I should say legislation by the courts, has set this new standard, all unconstitutional. Do you think they knew what they were doing? You bet they did. They've known what they've been doing, and they've been doing this to create more harm and to create more fear. So, all right, I've safely stepped down from that soapbox. So now we can go down to what George Mason starts to talk about regarding the exclusive legislation and why this, you know, this is one of the greatest evils. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, George Mason thought that there were few clauses in the Constitution so dangerous as that which gave Congress exclusive power of legislation within 10 miles square. Implication, he observed, was capable of any extension, would probably be extended to augment the congressional powers. But here there was no need of implication. This clause gave them an unlimited authority in every possible case within the district, within that district. This 10 miles square, says Mr. Mason, may set at defiance the laws of the surrounding states, and may, like the custom of the superstitious days of our ancestors, become the sanctuary of the blackest crimes. Here the federal courts are to sit. We have heard a good deal said of justice.
All right, so isn't that interesting that he was referring to D.C. as the superstitious days of their ancestors becoming the sanctuary of the blackest crimes? Isn't that true, though? But it's only true because the federal government is violating the Constitution, not because the exclusive legislation gave them the power to do it. No, they actually used legislation and basically they couldn't delegate. Then that's what they did. We covered this in the Organic Act. I don't know if you remember this, but this was the coup d'etat. This was the premium overstepping of the bounds when they actually formed a governor for the District of Columbia, and they actually formed a government of a representative body to basically take care of the people of the district. In other words, they were on the way of making the district a state. We've already covered here why the District of Columbia was not, or the seat of government was not to be a state. It was only for the function. It only exists for the federal government to do its functions. So you want to take your family there, and there's crime. Well, then don't take your family there. Now, there's a right to policing and protecting life and those types of things. Okay. But what they ended up doing was they created a small little city of 10 miles. And I don't know how big Singapore is. I'm sure it's bigger than 10 miles square. But, I mean, any city can literally become its own culture. And that was never the intent. The District of Columbia was to basically serve the union where the federal government functioned. It wouldn't become this sanctuary of the elitists to live and to rule us from. So now Madison, as always, Madison then goes and responds to Mr. Mason. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I did conceive, sir, that the clause under consideration was one of those parts which would speak to its own praise. It is hardly necessary to say anything concerning it. Strike it out of the system, and let me ask whether there would not be much larger scope for those dangers. I cannot comprehend that the power of legislating over a small district, which cannot exceed 10 miles square and may not be more than 1 mile, will involve the dangers which he apprehends. If there be any knowledge in my mind of the nature of man, I should think it would be the last thing that would enter into the mind of any man to grant exclusive advantages in a very circumscribed district to the prejudice of the community at large. We make suppositions and afterwards deduce conclusions from them as if they were established axioms. But after all, bring home this question to ourselves, it is probable that the members from Georgia, New Hampshire, etc. will concur to sacrifice the privileges of their friends. I believe that whatever state may become the seat of the general government, it will become the object of the jealousy and envy of the other states. Let me remark, if not already remarked, that there must be a cession by particular states of the district to Congress, and that the states may settle the terms of the cession. The states may make what stipulation they please in it, and if they apprehend any danger, they may refuse it altogether. How could the general government be guarded from the undue influence of particular states, or from insults, without such exclusive power? If it were at the pleasure of a particular state to control the session and deliberations of Congress, would they be secure from insults or the influence of such state? Is this commonwealth dependent for the freedom of deliberation on the laws of any state where it might be necessary to sit? Would it not be liable to attacks of that nature and with more indignity, which have been already offered to Congress? With respect to the government of Holland, I believe the states general have no jurisdiction over the Hague.
Yeah, over the Hague.
But I have heard that mentioned as a circumstance which gave undue influence to Holland over the rest. We must limit our apprehensions to certain degrees of probability. The evils which they urge must result from this clause are extremely improbable, nay, almost impossible.
Okay, so I know Madison is really marginalizing, but the whole point was that only Congress would be the ones making the laws. Only Congress would be dealing with this. And so what ended up happening, because the people of government, and as a matter of fact, I think it's the carnal nature of man to want the niceties availed to them. Right? In other words, you know,
absolutely.
Why can't I have my family with me? Because my family gives me pleasure. Well, I mean, you know, along with that, the single guys, well, why can't we have, you know, women? Because prostitution, you know, ended up coming into the district. All sorts of things started coming into the district because there was this, it's supply and demand. As a matter of fact, a guy that I met, his name is Aaron Tilbury. He was a part of the founding of the Jonah Project, where he's fighting the sex trafficking of children. And when I met him, he was educating people on this Underground Railroad that was literally moving children from Tijuana up into Seattle and across the top, and you know, throughout this elaborate network of moving sex children or children for sex purposes. And so he came down to the real problem. The only way we can get rid of the problem is to get rid of the demand, because as long as there's a demand, somebody's going to try to supply it. And 9 times out of 10, when there's such a lack of supply but such a great demand, the cost goes up. This is a point where, and this is just tragic and terrible, I think I interviewed him in my early years. And one of the things he points out is when a child is no longer has an appeal and is no longer, you know, desirable in the services. In other words, you know, they're becoming difficult, or they, you know, they're just not a, let me, instead of trying to stumble through this, let me collect myself. And when we come back, I'll explain what they do with the children as they grow up and try to become adults and have lives. I'll dive into that when we come back. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as Aaron was basically stating, that sometimes, depending on the conditioning of the child, if they truly break the child, then there may be a long return on their investment of this child working in this sex trade. However, if the child is, still has, you know, resistance or what have you, when they finally get to a point where they're just not making the money and it's not giving them the return on their investment, there's only one thing that they do with that child. They basically get rid of them. They kill them. They don't let them go and say, go enjoy your life. This child knows way too much, and there's no way they can afford to let that, you know, child get out and start talking. So
right.
It's a very dark, evil industry. These, and as a matter of fact, he gets into, you know, how they find these kids in school and how they isolate them and they, you know, convince them that, you know, to come along, and then they break them. I mean, this is just, it'll absolutely disgust you. So the point is that as we look at what happened to D.C., these types of things, because the demand of, I'll just say, these finer things, these enjoyments, these carnal pleasures, it goes in all directions. And so D.C. became a very opulent pot, no doubt about it. And as a matter of fact, out of all of the housing districts or housing areas in the United States, D.C. is the only one that never had a severe bubble pop. Folks, it's time we pop their bubble. It's time that all of those homes maybe get converted into, you know, maybe food, because Virginia is a great place to grow food. But to have all of those people working in Congress, how can we do this? Easy. This should have happened at the beginning of the 1900s, the 20th century. This should have happened with representation, when they could no longer put enough people into Congress to give us representation for every 30,000 citizens. Instead of taking away our representation, they should have actually started either building a bigger capital or letting everybody represent us from the state, even though we didn't have virtual ability to do that back in those days. There's no reason why we can't do it now, folks. No reason at all why we can't do it now. And so these are all, there's all sorts of solutions that fix these big problems. All sorts. And I believe reasonable people, legally informed, will come up with, you know, good ideas to actually make our government serve us the way it should be instead of the way they want to. If you let somebody take control who is supposed to serve you, they become your master. And I'm telling you, when they grab the reins, they're not nice people.
Yeah.
So Mr. Madison made that point that, you know, they, you know, he couldn't imagine why the Congress would even want these types of things. I think Madison downplayed the, you know, how opulence and how those types of things, because next thing you know, what happened? Because traveling was difficult, You know, these men were working for short periods of time, right? They were just in session. So people needed to stay there to kind of keep work going, like the General Accounting Office and those types of things. But the Congress and the Senate, they would go home. Well, eventually they started bringing their wives, and you know, it was decent. So they stayed there for the, you know, once the snow was over, they would all venture in and stay in their summer, or for the most of the year, they would stay in D.C. because everybody wants their creature comforts. That's another way of putting it. But bottom line, you know, this was inevitable because the carnal man is inevitable to do those things to please him. So, as Madison basically made that comment, Mr. Nicholas piped in as well on this exclusive territory. So, let's go ahead.
Mr. Nicholas insisted that as the state within which the 10-mile square might be could prescribe the terms on which the Congress should hold it, no danger could arise, as no state would consent to injure itself. There was the same security with respect to the places purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, etc. And as to the territory of the United States, the power of Congress only extended to make needful rules and regulations concerning it without prejudicing the claim of any particular state, the right of territory not being given up, that the grant of those lands to the United States was for the general benefit of all the states and not to be perverted to their prejudice, that consequently, whether that country were formed into new states or not, the danger apprehended could not take place, that the seat of the government was to be still a part of the state, and as to the general regulations, was to be considered as such.
Okay, so anything, you know, so what really jumped out to me? I was going to ask if anything jumped out to you, but I know you're probably busy, you know, just trying to enunciate and get the words right. It's difficult. I get it. The one thing that really comes out is this part that says there was the same security with respect to the places purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, and etc., and as to the territory of the United States, the power of Congress only extended to make needful rules and regulations concerning it. So how is it that Congress can actually make this jump to saying we control you and we can make any and all rules, we can take your property, we can do these, you know, these draconian things? They can't. And that's the whole point here, folks. This goes back to why, you know, on the other days Tammy's not here, I'm going through, you know, the Enabling Acts. I'm going through what was happening as the states were coming in and how Congress started playing this game of taking state land from them and selling it for their own benefit. So, and as I've even proven to you folks, that they're taking a good portion of this to help build D.C. so that they have good schools for their children. It didn't take them long. We're talking in the 1820s, they started saying, you know what, the 3 decades later, they said, you know, our wives are here and they're kind of, you know, nagging us to, you know, have better conditions so that we can bring the whole family. Why not have the family? We're family men. What kind of sacrifice is that? I mean, when we look at the military man, as a matter of fact, when I joined the Marine Corps, I had to have permission to get married.
Mm-hmm.
What that meant is if I went and got married without permission, I could be court-martialed. And as a matter of fact, yours truly made that mistake because he didn't understand. And when I showed up at my command that I was married, I was standing in front of my OIC, my officer in charge, and he says, you know, I have every right to court-martial you. And I was shaking in my boots. I said, sir, I didn't know. Or, you know, I was actually, I think it was a Lance Corporal. Sir, the Lance Corporal didn't know. And he goes, well, we've actually court-martialed people for doing this. And he looked at me and he goes, but we just transitioned into a voluntary force. And the reality is, if I court-martial you because you violated the law, then we'll have a hard time, if this gets into the public, we'll have a hard time recruiting people. So instead of court-martialing you, this is what they call NJP, non-judicial punishment, where you stand in front of the officer, and he has latitude to punish you without going into a court-martial. And so he punished me for 90 days or what have you. So anyway.
What was your punishment?
I don't want to get into it. Anyway, the point is that, you know, this is not your life. You're in service of the people. In this particular case, I volunteered to do it. When you get elected, you're volunteering to do this as well. And it's not about, you know, feeding yourself. It's about serving. And somehow it's all become, you know, no, it's about princes and it's about royalty and ruling instead of serving. So anyway, so this really jumps out that you have to understand that this whole area was not to be this, you know, this pompous place where theater and all of these types of things were to be. You had to go to the city to do that. D.C. was not a city of entertainment. But you know what? As soon as people from all sorts of other nations and worlds came and they said, you know, your district here sucks. You don't have any entertainment. You don't have because these people were, of course, carnal people. Many of them were probably evil people because there were lots of heathen nations back in those days. So anyway, as we go down a little further, then Madison kind of speaks up, and there's this kind of long note here. And then Mr. Pendleton then pipes in after Madison. So let's pick up this note by Mr. Madison, would you please?
Okay. The honorable member asks, why ask for this power, and if the subsequent clause be not fully competent for the same purpose? If so, what new terrors can arise from this particular clause? It is only a superfluity. If that latitude of construction which he contends for were to take place with respect to the sweeping clause, there would be room for those horrors. But it gives no supplementary power. It only enables them to execute the delegated powers. If the delegation of their powers be safe, no possible inconvenience can arise from this clause. It is, at most, but explanatory. For when any power is given, its delegation necessarily involves authority to make laws to execute it. Were it possible to delineate on paper all those particular cases and circumstances in which legislation by the general legislature would be necessary, and to leave the states all the other powers, I imagine no gentleman would object to it. But this is not within the limits of human capacity. The particular powers which are found necessary to be given are therefore delegated generally, and particular and minute specification is left to the legislature.
Okay, so at this point, Madison spoke so low that they really couldn't hear what he was saying. So there was this little, I'll just say, a break in what he actually said, and then all of a sudden when they could hear him again, this is what he said.
Okay. When the honorable member objects to giving the general government jurisdiction over the place of their session, does he mean that it should be under the control of any particular state that might, at a critical moment, seize it? I should have thought that this clause would have met with the most cordial approbation, as the consent of the state in which it may be must be obtained, and as it may stipulate the terms of the grant, should they violate the particular stipulations, it would be an usurpation, so that if the members of Congress were to be guided by the laws of their country, none of those dangers could arise.
Okay, and then he spoke some more, and still couldn't be heard. Okay, so I don't know if he was, you know, sick or tired at this point, but, you know, the point is, and I think this is the way I like to look at it. I think that when he was buoyed up by the Spirit, you know, he spoke so that everybody could hear him. Maybe these other points were really more for those other people. But the point is that we have more than enough of what he said and what the rest of these Federalists said in clarifying the Constitution, that we have full clarity as to the limited nature of this Constitution, the very few enumerations, the very few things that Congress can do, and can prove that everything that the federal government has assumed since the very beginning has been unconstitutional. And just because they could get away with it, because the states, by the time the states found out, they already got away with it. I'll give you a case in point. When Monroe took money out of the Treasury to buy a parcel of land in Africa, a territory, a small little territory, he colonized that with the Freedmen of America. They called it Liberia. And so he spent money under his presidency to basically repatriate former slaves or freedmen, black freedmen of America, to go back to Africa. And that's one of the reasons why the capital was Monrovia. So he spent that money. He didn't have the constitutional authority to do that. It's not enumerated in the Constitution. So when, you know, and anybody, when the states found out, it was already too late. What are they going to do? Slap his hands? And at this point, he was probably a lame duck president. The states, and this I think is a shortcoming. I believe that the states should actually petition for an impeachment. I don't believe that Congress, it would require the two-thirds of Congress or what have you. I believe that it should only require a significant majority, not two-thirds, but I would probably, two-thirds would be 34 states. But I think at a minimum, states should be able to step in and say, this president is violating his oath, and he needs to be impeached and removed. Does that make sense? I think the states should have that power.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because they're so corrupt, because Congress gave Biden a pass. We had 26 states immediately stand up against, and I think there was even more than that, but 26 states stood up against Obamacare. And as far as I'm concerned, they should have actually stood up and said, he needs to be impeached.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so Henry makes a quick comment. He replied that if Congress were vested with supreme power of legislation paramount to the Constitution and laws of the states, the dangers he had described might happen, for that Congress would not be confined to the enumerated powers. That I don't understand how Henry could make that connection. They're always tied to the enumerated powers. In other words, they had exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia to guard themselves and that's it. They didn't have the ability to create a government. They didn't have the ability to abdicate the responsibility of exclusive legislation and give it to a council of the District of Columbia to let them regulate and actually legislate and create law. The Constitution's clear. Only Congress has that exclusive legislative authority. For them to abdicate their responsibility requires an amendment. They'd actually have to strike that out to say, we no longer have exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia. Now it's just over the properties of the United States, i.e. the forts, dockyards, ship, arsenals, magazine, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so now Mr. Pendleton then responds regarding the exclusive legislation.
Mr. Chairman, this clause does not give Congress power to impede the operation of any part of the Constitution or to make any regulation that may affect the interests of the citizens of the Union at large. But it gives them power over the local police of the place so as to be secured from any interruption in their proceedings. Notwithstanding the violent attack upon it, I believe, sir, this is the fair construction of the clause. It gives them power of exclusive legislation in any case within that district. What is the meaning of this? What is it opposed to? It is opposed to the general powers of the federal legislature or to those of the state legislature. Is it opposed to the general powers of the federal legislature or to those of the state legislatures? I understand it is opposed to the legislative power of that state where it shall be. What then is the power? Is it that Congress shall exclusively legislate there in order to serve the police of the place and their own personal independence, and that they may not be overawed or insulted and of course to preserve them in opposition to any attempt by the state where it shall be. This is the fair construction. Can we suppose that, in order to effect these salutary ends, Congress will make it an asylum for villains and the vilest characters from all parts of the world? Will it not degrade their own dignity to make it a sanctuary for villains? I hope that no man will ever compose that Congress will associate with the most profligate characters.
Okay, so you laugh because we see how vile and see how problematic the District of Columbia and what they've allowed in there because of the corruption of money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so keep going.
Why oppose this power? Suppose it was contrary to the sense of their constituents to grant exclusive privileges to citizens residing within that place. The effect would be directly in opposition to what he says. It could have no operation without the limits of that district. Were Congress to make a law granting them an exclusive privilege of trading to the East Indies, it could have no effect the moment it would go without that place. For their exclusive power is confined to that district. Were they to pass such a law, it would be nugatory, and every member of the community at large could trade to the East Indies as well as the citizens of that district. This exclusive power is limited to that place solely for their own preservation, which all gentlemen allow to be necessary.
Okay. Does that make sense? I mean, reading these parts of the Constitution really helps you understand, you know, the details of this exclusive legislation. A. Ralph Epperson, who wrote The Unseen Hand, has completely perverted this concept of the exclusive legislation that it can apply to all things. Do you think what Pendleton and what Madison has said so far, you know, literally confines it, because as they stipulate, these are the legal definitions. Henry and everybody else can make these wild assertions, but as it has been stipulated, they can only extend this power to do these types of things. That's it. Now, they have bamboozled people to redefine things, but the problem is we need to continually read the ratification debate so that we understand how they've been confined. It's kind of like reading the scriptures to understand the Ten Commandments. You have to read these documents to understand how each of these lines were defined and sold by the proponents of the Constitution. Of course, the naysayers are going to tell you all evil will be unleashed because they're trying to keep you from utilizing this new system. But those who designed it, and when we read through the Constitutional Convention, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, there was no hint of these types of things. Period. So the only way that they could start actually using these things in a different way than defined is they have to redefine it. Does Congress have any authority in the Constitution to redefine the Constitution itself? No, nor does the Supreme Court. No, nor does the president. They have to go by how it was justified and stipulated at the time of ratification. Now, okay, wow, it's been 200 some years since then. You know, who knows what was stipulated? Well, that's your fault. The only reason that they've been getting away with redefining all this crap to ad nauseum is because we have been ignorant of how it was defined. We've been ignorant of the meaning of the law, which is why I've been doing this for years for you. Yeah, this is a service. I don't do this for money. But I'm paying Tammy a lot of money. Anyway.
Yes.
I'm just kidding. So, and I appreciate Tammy's time and service, and we just can't get enough of how to do this. So, actually, this next one is not highlighted, but I have to go in and highlight it because it goes kind of all the way down to the end. Because it's all pertinent. So just consider that where it says militia, they say that the state governments have no power at all over the militia. Go ahead and pick that up all the way down to George Mason, and then George Mason starts complaining again about the sweeping clause. So go ahead.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, gentlemen say there is no new power given by this clause. Is there anything in this Constitution which secures to the states the powers which are said to be retained? Will powers remain to the states which are not expressly guarded and reserved? I will suppose a case. Gentlemen may call it an impossible case, and suppose that Congress will act with wisdom and integrity. Among the enumerated powers, Congress are to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, and to pay the debts, and to provide for the general welfare and common defenses. And by that clause, so often called the sweeping clause, they are to make all laws necessary to execute those laws. Now suppose oppression should arise under this government, and any rider should dare to stand forth and expose the community at large the abuses of those powers, could not Congress, under the idea of providing for the general welfare, and under their own construction, say that this was destroying the general peace, encouraging sedition, and poisoning the minds of the people? And could they not, in order to provide against this, lay a dangerous restriction on the press? Might they not even bring the trial of this restriction within the 10-mile square when there is no prohibition against it? Might they not thus destroy the trial by jury? Would they not extend their implication? It appears to me that they may and will, and shall the support of our rights depend on the bounty of men whose interest it may be to oppress us? That Congress should have the power to provide for the general welfare of the Union, I grant, but I wish a clause in the Constitution with respect to all powers which are not granted, that they are retained by the states. Otherwise, the power of providing for the general welfare may be perverted to its destruction.
And it's been used, but it's to use it, you have to redefine it. And so I understand what Mason's saying, but who are the ones that were supposed to keep their eye on whether they were redefining, whether they were playing these types of shenanigans and changing the meaning and what those clauses meant and how the Constitution was stipulated? I understand that back in those days, they weren't very mature in contract law. They didn't do audits on a regular basis. They didn't actually, you know, and why is it the state's not actually coming in? Trump should not be doing DOGE. The state should actually be coming in and actually auditing all of the powers and say, hold up. Where did you get the authority to do these things? This should be happening on a regular basis. Because you know they're going to try to get out of and do more with the power that they want to concoct. Now, we ended up missing the part before that we didn't get. And so I will, when we come back, we'll actually read those two paragraphs of militia that I pointed to that I said they weren't highlighted, but I'm highlighting them. So go ahead and read those. But
okay. Anyway,
so we'll be back and diving more into this, folks. It's obvious that in Virginia, they're really getting into the nuts and bolts of the Constitution, and they're actually letting the fur fly, if you know what I mean. So with that, we will be back in going through these things to help you understand just how important the ratification debates are. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.